So you might remember that we talked about that a little bit in the statistical mechanics course. And here we're just gonna review some of the main points and some of the notation that's gonna be needed later in the course. But this is the sampling that's used to generate some of the data samples that are used when training neural networks to classify phases. So in particular, the data that I'm gonna give you for homework one from the Ising model, that was generated using Monte Carlo. But also later on next week, when we're gonna talk about unsupervised learning done using restricted Boltzmann machines, we're also gonna use Monte Carlo sampling within those algorithms. So it's good to be familiar with the notation. And then with whatever time we have left, I just wanted to summarize everything we saw in week one and just talk about all the different hyperparameters that we've been talking about through the week. Because I think that's a theme that keeps coming up is how many different hyperparameters we have to vary in these neural networks and how that's a whole new problem in itself. So we have the problem we're trying to study that might be classifying phases, but then we have these problems of all these hyperparameters. So I think it's good to just kind of remember for ourselves all the different hyperparameters that we've seen. And so just looking ahead to when we do that summary, I just wrote down again all these different acronyms that we've been seeing throughout the week, just in case you've forgotten any of them. Okay. So we're going to be talking today about Monte Carlo sampling in the context of classical systems, for which we know the Hamiltonian. Okay, so one thing we would like to be able to do often when we're doing Monte Carlo is we'd like to be able to calculate the expectation value of a certain quantity. And for our purposes here, another thing that we want to do is given a temperature, we want to be able to get many states that are characteristic of that temperature. So the expectation value that I'm trying to calculate is just some weighted sum over states. And the methods we're going to talk about are pretty general. They can apply for various distributions, but for these systems, so for example, for the Ising model that we're going to be looking at on the homework, the distribution is given by this function where Z is my partition function, and beta is just this inverse temperature. And from these expressions, we already see an indication of this problem being difficult, because in order to calculate these expectation values, we need to do a sum over all possible states of our system if we want to calculate them directly. But for a system with, say, n spins, this sum is going to scale, the number of terms in that sum is going to be exponential in n. Okay, so we can't evaluate those sums directly. So the idea of our Monte Carlo sampling is that what we want to do is, instead of summing over all states, we want to sum over just some smaller subset of states. But we want to choose that subset in a smart way. Okay, so when we are doing our sampling, what we want to do is get some subset of m states and use that to estimate our expectation value. And for our purposes, we also want to use these states as data for our neural network. So these states are going to be our input data. And again, the goal of the algorithms that we're going to design is to choose these states in a smart way, so that the ones that have larger probability are actually selected with higher probability in this subset. And if we can find a way to do that, so that the probability of selecting a state is given by the actual probability that we want, then we can actually estimate this expectation value by just summing over the values that we get. So we no longer need this factor of probability in the sum because these states are selected with that probability. And this selection process, where the states that are more probable are more likely to be chosen, is called important sampling. Does anybody have any questions so far?
Where you, we know the probability from?
So, I mean, this is something we know from the type of setup that we have. So we know based on the temperature of our system and the energy of our system, yes. We know, yeah. But actually it can be more general. This would be in, say, the icing model that we're going to talk about. This is the distribution that we want, but the theory I'm describing is more general. So if you had some other distribution that you wanted to sample from, you can.
So you just basically get a distribution and then you make some simulations and you say, okay, with this distribution, I don't know, 10,000 times, give me samples with this distribution, right?
Yeah, I think so. So I think I'm understanding right. So if you have some set of states that you want to sample from, but you know how they should be distributed, then yeah.
Distributed, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know that one state is, for example, in the medians, which I have to take more often.
Yeah.
So I don't need any machine learning for that. I can do it.
No, this is not, yeah. So what I'm describing now is not in itself machine learning, but we are going to use it as input to machine learning. And actually, then next week, we're going to see there are machine learning algorithms that use Monte Carlo sampling within the algorithm.
Yeah, so yeah. You just explained how the sampling preparation works.
Yeah, exactly. These ideas are more general. So right now you're not seeing how they would fit into machine learning, but we'll see that next week. Okay, and now I still haven't really told you yet how we sample these states. So we're going to sample the... In Monte Carlo, we can use something called Markov chain Monte Carlo sampling. So Markov chain Monte Carlo, then now we're going to abbreviate that with MCM. And what that really means is that if we're in a given state, we're going to get the next state in our subset from that initial state. So by making some change to that state we started in, we'll get another state representative of our distribution. Okay, so what could this look like if, let's go to a model we've actually talked about. So let's look at this icing model. So maybe I'm in a state that if I just zoom in on this little 2x2 region, looks like this. Then one thing I could do is I could propose a move to this state, which is just different by one flip of this algorithm, of one flip of this 2x2 grid. Or if I want to think about the gauge theory, doesn't have to be just one flip. Maybe I want to propose something where I flip two, for example. So I haven't told you in general whether we're actually going to use this state as our next one. But the way this sampling works is I propose something. I start here and I can propose anything. And now I'm going to show you how to make sure that the proposals we actually accept are going to ensure that we respect the right distribution. So there are many different algorithms possible for proposing these moves. You could just try flipping one or two. There's also algorithms that propose non-local moves. So they'll flip some whole cluster of spins. Okay, so we generate any proposal that we want, and then we have to choose whether to accept or reject it. And the notation we're going to use to indicate the probability of both proposing and accepting a move is called the transition probability. And of course, if we're in a state, we have to be able to somehow get to another state. So we have to have this normalization condition that the sum over all the possible states we can transition to have to give us one. Okay, and maybe you'll remember from the previous course in statistical mechanics back in October that we can choose these transition probabilities as in many different ways, but they have to satisfy two conditions. Does anyone remember what one of those conditions might be?
Detailed balance.
Detailed balance, yeah. Remember what the other one is? Anyone? That's great, yeah.
No.
Yeah, Matt?
Ergodic.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Yeah. So those are the two. So the two conditions are called detailed balance and it has and also the updates have to be ergodic. So let's talk about what we mean by ergodic first. So what I mean by that is that we always have to have some probability of including any state in this sample. So there can't be some subspace of our state space that's just never going to get included. So if I just choose two states at random, mu and nu, there has to be some way with non-zero probability that I can transition between them. And it doesn't have to be within one move. It could be within many moves, but there has to be some way that doesn't have zero probability that allows me to get between these two states. Okay. And then, as Carlos said, the other condition is detailed balance. Detailed balance is a way of ensuring that our probabilities are not changing with time. So the rate of transition into and out of any state has to be the same. And a way that we can make sure that happens is with this detailed balance equation. So I'll call that DB for detailed balance. You guys can still read here? Yeah. And so let's just go back to the case that we're going to be using where we have this Boltzmann distribution for our probability. then we get an equation that just tells us that the ratio of our transition probabilities just has to satisfy this exponential of the energy difference between those states. And you notice that this normalization factor cancels out now. This normalization factor that also involves a sum over an exponential number of states, it cancels out here. We don't actually need it. All we care about is that is the ratio of these probabilities. I'm going to leave that one up so that we still have that outline, and I'll just erase this board. Okay, so you'll remember that I was emphasizing earlier that if we're going to transition from mu to nu, so this probability here, this transition probability, this involves two things. It involves proposing a move, and it also involves accepting a move. So that is going to lead us to introduce the following notation. So in this expression, we have something called a selection probability and also an acceptance probability. So this is the probability that our algorithm is going to propose that move. And this is the acceptance probability. So if our algorithm, whatever that algorithm is, if our algorithm somehow proposes that we move to state nu, this is the probability that we'll accept that move. And in here, the selection probability, this is where we would incorporate the different kinds of moves that we might want to do. So if we're talking about an algorithm that's just a single spin flip, then our probability of moving from mu to nu is going to just be it's going to just only be non-zero for the moves that correspond to single spin flip. So this is kind of where we have our freedom of designing our algorithm. But then we have to make sure that we accept moves in a way that we satisfy our constraints that we have. Okay, so with these constraints, though, another thing we're going to want to do is design moves in a way that our acceptance probabilities are going to be fairly high, because we don't want to just keep staying in the same state. If I just keep proposing moves and then rejecting them, I'm just going to stay in state mu forever. And then my subset of states that I'm going to be sampling is just going to be all the same state. That's not actually going to be very representative of my distribution. So now I'm just solving for these acceptance probabilities from the detailed balance constraints. So I know that they have to be given by this ratio of my selection probabilities and my target distribution that I want to sample from. And so the Metropolis algorithm, is often useful within many other algorithms for ensuring that we're maximizing these acceptances. And the point is that in all of these algorithms, the equations we have to satisfy are ratios. So here, my acceptances can be anything as long as the ratio between them satisfies this quantity, this ratio on the right. And so what that means is that if I consider a move mu to nu, and I also consider the move nu back to mu, one of them I can always accept, and the other one I have to incorporate. This ratio where I don't always accept that move. So the idea is that because I only need to satisfy this ratio, I can always choose one of these probabilities to be equal to one.
Are you allowed to propose to stay in the state that you're in?
You could, but I don't know why you would do that. Why you?
Because you're picking them at random. I'm wondering if that's in the allowed pool of proposals.
Yeah, and if you, so, I mean, usually what it is that you propose a different move, and then if you reject it, you'd stay in the same state.
Okay.
So there are many times when you, yep. Your next state is the same one. In this algorithm, for example, okay. So if we actually go here, if we're using this algorithm. If we propose to stay in the same state, our energy wouldn't change. And so, okay, if you just wanted to always propose to stay in the same state, I think you would actually just accept that trivially. You would just, because the ratio of your probabilities here would just be one, p mu, your new state here is the same as, sorry, nu is the same as mu. So if you're using this, you would just trivially accept that. But that wouldn't really satisfy our ultimate goal, which is getting a good approximation of this expectation value and sampling.
I'm just wondering, like, when you code this, do you, like, specifically, like, exclude the proposal of staying in the same state?
It depends. So it would depend on the algorithm. So in a single spin flip algorithm, I guess you would, because the way it works is that you start in some state and you choose a state at random and you propose flipping it. So then you would never be proposing staying in the same state. But there could be some algorithms that are maybe developed recursively that in principle, maybe there's a case where the proposal would never actually generate anything and you would actually propose staying in the same state. So yeah, it's probably possible in some algorithms.
In general, in Markov chain, every state has some probability to return to itself, except mm-hmm. for the very first initial state.
First, in it, why is that state special?
Because you don't want to, because if you initiate, you have to go somewhere, you can't stay in there.
Oh, you can't stay there forever? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's basically this constraint here, that you always have to be able to move to any other state, but,
yeah, but there's also some probability, of course, for different tasks, it's defined differently, but there is always a probability to if you're not an initial point, to stay where you are.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And just to emphasize, though, that the point of moving to another state, that does have to be non-zero in probability, but it doesn't have to be on the next step that it's non-zero. It just has to be there's some chain of steps that you can do. Like, it's not always, if you're in state one, your state two, it maybe can't be just anything with your algorithm. Maybe there's only some set of states that your algorithm is going to propose, but eventually you could move to any other state.
The next step can be exactly the same as
yeah.
the current state.
Yeah, it can, yeah, definitely. Okay, so just to summarize these ideas, I'm just going to write out the steps of a sampling algorithm. Okay, so if I have some distribution P mu, for example, maybe this is going to be a distribution corresponding to a given temperature, and I want to sample M states from it, this is what I could do. So let's say I'm already starting in state mu 1. I also have to think about how to get to that state. So in principle, what I would do is I would run my algorithm starting in a random state. I would run it for a long time, until I'm convinced that I'm in a state that's actually representative of my distribution. But let's just say when I'm writing this down that this algorithm is going to start from a point where it's already got the first state in this chain. Sorry, I'm just realizing this is, I'm going to put this on the next side because I don't want to, I'm going to run out of space. So we start in that state. And there's a bunch of steps within this loop. Okay, so I'm going to use these selection probabilities to propose a move to some state new. And then I have to decide whether I'm going to accept it. So I'm going to, the code to actually decide whether you want to accept it, I would generate a random number from a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. Now, if I find that that random number is less than my acceptance probability, that means I'm going to accept the move. So the next state in my chain is going to be this proposed move. And otherwise, I'm going to just keep that same state. So I think this fits with what you guys were saying, that there's always some chance that my next state is going to be the same as before. Unless my acceptance is 1 for doing a move. And sometimes I can generate algorithms where my acceptance is 1.
Particular states have very highly correlated, right? So then after one state, there always should be something else, right? I don't know if it's a thing with...
It doesn't even mean that you... Wait, that your states, these ones are correlated, you mean, or?
For example, imagine there are two states which, like, I don't know, always have to be together, you know?
Oh.
Your experiment, you know that, so then you put acceptance rate one, because you know that once this state appears, another one also should appear.
Yeah, you could have cases where, like, two states are very likely, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be next to each other in this sampling chain.
Yeah, in the sampling, we just do the sampling. It doesn't matter how they invest inside the sampling.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's right. Yeah.
In this case.
Yeah. Yes. And so, but even the fact that our algorithm could have a very high acceptance, it doesn't mean we'll never get back to the same state again.
No,
we could. Yeah, we can. Yeah. Okay, so any questions about Monte Carlo sampling? Because if not, I just want to summarize some things about what we saw regarding neural network. Yeah?
It looks a lot like simulated annealing.
Yeah, so I guess simulated annealing, well, is there something you've been reading about simulated annealing?
Kind of a while ago, so. Basically, like the, I think A of mu to V is usually like a Boltzmann distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you kind of accept with that probability and you reject otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. And in simulated annealing, you're often also using some principles of changing your temperature. So, I mean, here we're kind of talking about the sampling you would do at a given temperature. And I guess it depends on the context you're talking about, but often in what you're saying, I think you would also have this concept of if you wanted to sample at a low temperature, it maybe takes a long time to converge to the right distribution. So sometimes you, you'll start at a higher temperature and you'll cool down. So ideas like that, you'll incorporate some change, some cooling down in temperature to make sure that you're converging and in the right way. And it can help you prevent getting stuck in a local minimum. Because another thing, again, that I didn't explain is that I'm just assuming here that I'm starting in a good state. But if I don't start in a good state, I could actually be stuck in a local minimum that I'm not actually sampling the right distribution. So simulated annealing can help you to make sure that doesn't happen. Yeah, that's a good point. OK. So let's try to think about, in a very broad way, what we've seen so far. So on the first day, we kind of motivated that we want to use machine learning within many-body physics. And we talked about how there's two methods that we're going to look at in this course. One is supervised learning, one is unsupervised learning. And then we just decided to just focus on one kind of supervised learning, which was these feed-forward neural networks. Thank you. And then yesterday we started to talk about an application within many-body physics is classifying phases of matter. So yesterday in the tutorial, you classified phases of this icing gauge theory without using machine learning. You did it with knowledge of the theory, but we talked yesterday about how we might be able to use these feed-forward neural networks to classify these phases of matter. And you're going to do this on your homework for the icing model. And so just to give you an idea of what's coming up next week, so starting Monday, Juan is going to be here, and he's going to tell you a little bit about convolutional neural networks, which is a modification we can make to these feed-forward neural networks. And then we're going to talk about different methods we can use within unsupervised learning. So that's also coming up next week. And we're going to talk about a few different branches. So a few different types of algorithms that we can use within unsupervised learning. OK, so now I want to get another new board, actually. Because in the last 10 minutes, I just kind of want us to have time to just discuss kind of all that we've seen this week and maybe just make a summary list of all the different hyperparameters that we have to vary in the neural networks that we've been seeing and talking about. And before I forget, maybe I'll just say now that on Monday, there's going to be a seminar from a visiting researcher in the afternoon. So that's on the calendar. And I'll post about it on the Slack channel as well. But I really encourage you guys to go, especially if you're still looking for ideas for what to write about in this blog post assignment. I think it can be really useful to see what people are doing within the machine learning community to get some inspiration. So I really encourage you to go to this seminar on Monday afternoon. We'll also have a lecture Monday morning, but. And then in the last week, there'll be another seminar like that, and there'll also be a colloquium by somebody that's doing research in machine learning that those of you who are at the Winter School will be familiar with his work. So that'll be a pretty exciting colloquium in the last week. So let's now. Recap these different hyperparameters in these neural network algorithms that we've seen so far. So, does anyone want to start? Tell me something that you need to, something you could adjust or try different methods for in these algorithms.
Number of hidden layers.
Yeah, number of hidden layers, yeah. Let's, within that category, maybe let's also say like number of neurons in the layer. Yeah. I just wanted to emphasize that this is what really defines how deep your network is, this point. So there's different definitions of what deep learning really is, actually. Some people would say it just means you have more than one hidden layer. I know I've heard Juan say a definition that it's when the number of parameters in your network is more than the number of parameters in your data. So there's different definitions, but it's based on the number of layers and the number of neurons in each layer. What else? What else? Yeah, activation. Oh, you guys are saying it in the same order that I wrote it down. It seems like it was planned. No, it's awesome. Yeah, it's great. And so what were some activation functions that we saw? And they can be different in each layer is another thing, right?
Sigmoid, what's it called, the very simple one.
Perceptron?
Perceptron, yes. Uh-huh.
What else? What was another one?
Rectified linear.
Yeah.
I don't remember any other. I mean,
that's
there
fine.
There are more of them.
Yeah, there was like.
I have a question.
Tan, hyperbolic tan. Yeah.
They all like non-linear, and why are people not using polynomial functions? Because basically you can approximate everything non-linear with polynomials.
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure. Does anybody know the answer to that question?
Why
people don't use like polynomial functions to do as their activation function?
Wouldn't you just be creating more parameters that you need to tweak then? Because like you would have like one coefficient for like x cubed, another for x squared kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's a good point actually. But then yeah, you would have to be. Yeah, I mean, you could try something simple with some simple coefficient.
I know that there are some activations where they do have parameters you can tweak, but usually it's just like one.
Uh-huh.
Like there's something called like a leaky ReLU.
Yeah.
Basically, like you kind of, instead of letting it go to zero in the negative, you kind of give it a really small slope.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, that's so. Yeah, some of them do have parameters, but yeah, Pablo.
I think also if you don't use a nonlinear activation function, your neural network just reduces to a simple like logistic regression.
That's right. Yeah.
Just a binary classification or something.
Okay.
So you have polynomial, you can't really have that like two steps kind of thing.
Oh,
right?
I see. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely it has to be nonlinear, but yeah, you're right. Probably these time of functions have these nice properties, yeah. But I mean, it's also something you can try again, because some reasons for why we choose things are just based on performance, right? So yeah.
I'm thinking it's like neural networks are mostly for classifications, is it? As far as I understood, maybe indeed because it's easy, classifying it's
mm-hmm.
all or nothing usually.
Yeah, then it's what Pablo was saying, that these functions, lots of them have this property where it's kind of like on or off in a way, but in a smooth way. So. What else? What other parameters do we need to be aware of?
There were parameters for gradient descent. This,
yeah.
I remember the lambda.
Yeah, so.
I don't remember what it does, but.
Yeah, so. Well, first of all, even what type of training we would use, right?
Right?
Whether we even do gradient descent or some variant on it, right? Yeah. So we saw gradient descent, stochastic gradient descent, adding momentum, right? All these choices. And we also talked about how you could even use some combination of these methods, right? But then within those, as you just pointed out, there's also parameters within each method. So one was called the learning rate. We called this eta. If we're using stochastic gradient descent, we have to divide into mini batches, and we can choose what size those are. What else? The momentum parameter. That was kind of controlling how much we're going to weight our current gradient with the sum of previous gradients. And then if we were using this dropout method, we had some probability of masking out neurons. So kind of how many we're going to mask out on average. That's another one. What else?
Cost function.
Cost function, perfect, yeah. What cost functions did we?
Minimum square.
Yeah.
And the cross entropy.
Yeah. And what else? We saw something else related to the cost function that we could do.
Regularization.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And also what kind of regularization, right? So we can control how much we add, what kind we add. So how much regularization, we were controlling that with this parameter lambda. And also what kind. Okay, so I have at least one more that I wrote down. You guys might even think of more, but something else. Maybe we haven't even talked about it that much, but.
Like splitting it into the testing and checking data or not?
Yeah, so I guess we could do that splitting in different ways, but I guess that's more a property of our data than of our training, yeah. But what about, so, you know, we talked about these different issues of different networks getting stuck in different local minimums sometimes. So maybe we train two networks with two different random seeds and we saw they had different behavior, right? So this is because of the way that we're initializing our network, right? So there's also different choices for how we initialize our weights and biases. So we didn't even really play with changing that in the tutorial, but we can choose our weights and biases to all start at zero. We could choose them from some Gaussian distribution. If we're using a different distribution, we can control the width of that distribution. So there's also parameters related to how we initialize our weights. And, you know, even if we are always choosing them in the same way, if we always choose them from the same distribution, we'll still could possibly get different results because we all use different random seeds every time that we train. So I think one point that's really worth mentioning here is that on top of the theory that we're trying to understand from physics, so in our application, for example, we're trying to classify phases of matter, but we see that when we're using machine learning as a tool, all of this, all of these other parameters that we have to vary are a whole other theory in themselves of how do we really choose each of these things in an optimal way. And so one thing I was trying to emphasize in the explanation of this blog assignment is that there are some people that are trying to use existing theories from physics to come up with explanations for how to choose these different hyperparameters or how to choose certain structures of your neural network or how to explain what each layer of your neural network is doing. So there's some people that are trying to understand maybe how if you have a network with many layers, maybe it's doing something like renormalization group procedure where every layer is doing something different. But that's kind of trying to use a theory from physics that we've had for many years from renormalization group to explain some of these phenomena in machine learning. So that's another option for your project for homework 3 is that you can read about something that maybe people have come up with an idea for how to take something from physics and explain something that we observe in these neural networks, either different variations with a hyperparameter or how to understand kind of what the output from each layer is or something like that. Okay, do you guys have any questions? Carlos, do you want to emphasize anything else about hyperparameters? Carlos was very very enthusiastic about emphasizing the point of how hard it is to vary hyperparameters, because he's struggling with that in his project. So anything you want
to
add?
Oh yeah, it is quite a horrible thing to search for good hyperparameters to actually learn stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it's really funny because sometimes for A or B reason, a certain choice of hyperparameters is very good for remnants, for Ising models, but then another certain choice of hyperparameters makes sense for other kind of data, and this search is really painful because it's like you could say, you could maybe try to say, can we do gradient descent on the search of hyperparameters, but you cannot define a gradient in a very comfortable way, so it's like you have to be a bit creative to how you search about how to search for hyperparameters.
I think, Lucine, you were asking, you were kind of asking about that yesterday. You were saying, why can't we just make some big database of, you know, if this is my kind of data, these should be my hyperparameters. But then it's hard to know what you actually need to know about that data in order to determine those hyperparameters. It's a really complicated problem,
like
right?
If you, you know, like a generalized cost function, right? It's like your testing accuracy, right? Or your accuracy of the neural network. Then you pick a set of hyperparameters, and for that set of hyperparameters, you train your neural network, which might take minutes, hours, whatever, and then say, it gave me this number. Now
you
have to test with other hyperparameters, and you train from scratch or whatever
the
network, and then you have another number.
Yeah.
It's like super painful, you know.
And then I think there's also the point that even if you get one number, you don't even know, you know, what if I just like use a different seed to initialize? Am I going to consistently get the same answer? Or was I just stuck somewhere and I won't usually be stuck? So you actually then usually would probably want to do it many times to make sure that answer is actually consistent, right? So.
And then you end up throwing a lot of machine power into it, you know, a lot of computer time and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to find parameters, though, can be a thing for biological data, for example, because it all has the same alphabet for DNA, and usually there is not much difference. So if you already have a successful set of parameters for one research, they're not that different.
Yeah, so...
Same.
If you had some really
data, it might work too.
So you're saying you have some really big data set, then maybe essentially you're going to be able to train a network and then save it and then just keep using it, right? Because you already have a good network.
Yeah, so if you have a good big data set in which you put data you used and you also put there the parameters that you use and the description of the model you used, then later you can train train a different algorithm to look through this data and see which of these data is most similar to your own data.
Mm-hmm.
Suggest you at least some set of parameters to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But in biology, in bioinformatics, it's much easier because data are usually very similar and described as you know. Set of the DNA code.
Yeah.
Of course, there are exceptions, but most of the time it's pretty similar.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's nice. Yeah. Okay, anything else you guys want to talk about?
Going off the point of finding optimal hyperparameters, there's actually like a really cool subject that people can read up on called Bayesian optimization.
Mm-hmm.
It basically, like, one of the applications of that is to be able to like optimize like really noisy functions, but that you can't actually evaluate that often.
Mm.
So like one of the original applications of this was sort of like trying to figure out like what experiments to do, because like experiments could take like weeks to do, and like you'd need to like change some different parameters for that. And then like one of the things people are doing now is applying that to like really big neural networks. And like you would tweak like one of the parameters and like you'd let it run for like a day, and then it would actually just feed back into the algorithm and just go in a cycle.
Mm. Yeah, that's cool.
And I can post a link on the Slack channel.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, that's another point is that, if you guys come across anything interesting, because really the literature in machine learning is just so broad and so diverse, and there's so many cool things and so many different ways that you can study it. So if you come across some interesting reference or an interesting blog post, I really encourage you to post it on the Slack. And anything interesting that you find or anything you want to discuss, because there's just so many different things we can talk about. Okay, well, have a good weekend, guys. And yeah, on Monday, we're going to have Juan here and a seminar in the afternoon.